And that is, it is the problem of putting the calls out. Like, you put the calls out, and why would they trust me?
Welcome back, Intimates. Thanks for your support on Patreon, making this 2021 season possible. This podcast is about all things intimate: relationships, love, connection, community, consensual non-monogamy, kink, orgies, lovers, and of course, good old-fashioned sex. I talk with old friends and even meet some new ones. I interview people from all walks of life, from recovered addicts to counselors, sex partners to perfect strangers. I'd like to thank my hosts, the Musqueam First Nation, as this podcast is recorded on their unceded ancestral territory, where I was born, where I work, and where I currently live and play. So settle in for an intimate conversation. Dr. Joey Hamilton is back yet again to share her wisdom. Today we'll be talking about plastic psyches and healing attachment injury. She talks about why she studies jealousy and why she studies it specifically how she does. We do a quick call in after the show about sex versus gender language, and we talk about why she labels her research how she does. Feel free to check out Dr. Hamilton's TEDx talk or visit her site at joliehamilton.com. Thank you so much for listening and enjoy. Welcome everyone to another session of Intimate Interactions. I'm here with Dr. Joli Hamilton, the relationship coach, research psychologist, TEDx speaker, best-selling author, ASEC certified sex educator, and co-host of the Project Relationship podcast. She has been featured in the New York Times, Vogue, NPR, and The Atlantic, and of course now here, and has spent more than two decades studying reimagining what love can be if we open our imaginations to possibility. Thank you so much for being with us on Intimate Interactions, Dr. Joli Hamilton.
Thanks for having me, Victor. This is such juicy conversation. I love
I'm absolutely, like, I adore you and the conversations we've been having.
I'm already like, oh, I'm going to need to transcribe this one. This was good nuggets we got
I'm
here.
I'm glad. Yeah, so I'm curious, you were talking a lot about the links sort of between jealousy and compersion and like early childhood attachment stuff. And I was super curious what your read is on ABCT, or for the uninitiated, the attachment-based compassion therapy that sort of, it came out in literature, I think, in like either 2015 or like 2016. And it was like all about trying to improve attachment injury, which prior to that, like a lot of the books that I had read said you can't change your attachment style.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, first off, thank God, because I was trained in psychodynamics. So, you know, Bowlby's tradition, Bowlby and Ainsworth's the tradition, the idea that attachment style is a thing. Like they named a phenomenon that they witnessed, right? That's how theory is made. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that they ever intended to say that this is fixed and forever necessarily, mm-hmm. but it's what happened, right? Like it's really... As a theorist myself, I'm like, ooh, it is really easy for me to put an idea out there about jealousy and for somebody else to hear it in conversation, pick it up, run right. with it. And I'm like, ooh, that was not a finished thought. I was just talking. this work is living in me right now. And how I process it is by having conversations like this. Like, you are part of my research now. Mm. Your words are. So when I think of going way back to that, I think, yeah, I'm not sure. Did anybody stop and ask them? And then did they study and say, absolutely, this is fixed and forever? Right. And no psychologist of merit would ever say something is totally fixed forever and we have no idea what we could do right. about it. It's just not scientific. It's not compassionate. It's not helpful. So I can understand why we got the idea, though, because, and this is a problem I see coming up all the time, is people over-identify with their assigned attachment style. So you take a 20-question quiz, and all of a sudden you're like, I'm anxiously attached.
Right.
And then you wear it like a badge, right? So if people felt some level of seenness, right, they felt seen, reflected by the early attachment theorists, great, they picked it up. But when we identify something, we put ourselves at grave risk of missing that we are a whole individual. We are a whole individual. So my take on ABCT is, thank God somebody said it. Thank mm-hmm. goodness somebody said, these things are not mm-hmm. fixed. There's always going to be a chance for you to do your psychological work. That's the whole concept of psychology. Psyche means soul, right? It's you aren't a fixed, you're not a computer algorithm running out and like, boom, done.
Right.
You are alive. You get to interact with your own growth. I I love that the word compassion is right in there. It makes sense to me that if we show ourselves compassion, mm-hmm. and we move back toward the idea that we can actively grow, change, learn, and create circumstances in which we can fully develop our self, you know, capital S self.
Yes.
Yay, the world gets better. Like, I think that's why we're conscious beings, personally. Like, that's one of my ontological beliefs is mm-hmm. I think that we're conscious beings because we can do that work. Like, that's what we're here for. And to name it, to just name it and say, hey, this isn't fixed. There's stuff we can do. I think it's just a formality, because I think a lot of people grew up in households that were really traumatizing or grew up in circumstance, war-torn. There are a million sure. ways you could grow up and experience major attachment trauma. Mm-hmm. And then some of those people go on to have really delicious relationships that feel nurturing and caring, and they create families and communities that allow them to grow past it. And those aren't the stories we tend to hear. Mm-hmm. So we didn't hear about the healing first. We hear about, oh my gosh, did you see, did you hear what attachment is? And if you don't have it, all these bad things. And how I see this play out in my classroom. So I teach human sexuality at the university level, and at least one student, if not more, in every class, when I tell them your attachment style is not fixed, at least one of them raises their hand and says, what? It's not, I can, wait, what? And we shift potentially the course of their whole life right. over the course of the next 10 or 15 minutes while other students talk about the ways that they have
right.
experienced trauma and then redressed it. And that's like, I would teach the class just to have that conversation.
Has been the exact opposite. Like when someone told me in a conversation I had, I think in like 2018, that mm-hmm. I couldn't change my attachment style because they were reading a book that was published. I was like, no, that can't be right. Like that so doesn't align with my internal, you know, lived experience. And I was like, we can't change it. He's like, yeah, you know, this doctor and this person who's like a master's of whatever is just, they've said it in their book Attached. And I was like, really? And so I just went on this like Google spree in 2018 and was like, oh, thank God. Well, I found other doctors that completely contradict that. So I'm going to find the information that supports my opinion. Thank you very much. And then just like.
Yeah. Well, it is. It supports your growth.
It does.
It supports your growth as a human. I just don't see where there's any help in saying, yep, that's broken. It can't ever be fixed. And that is actually, maybe that's exactly my trauma playing out, because that's what I was told when I was a child.
Oh, interesting.
You're broken. It can't be fixed.
Oh, yeah. I definitely got a lot of the same. Maybe that is why we're so committed to personal growth and like changing things.
Yeah.
But yeah, in a post neuroplasticity world, like where we have that concept and we understand that, it's so interesting to me that some people are so invested in being fixed. It's like it justifies where they are to know they can't be anywhere else.
Right. It's that's that identification that I was mentioning. When we become over-identified with anything, and that could be, you know, being good. You could be over-identified with having a secure attachment right. pattern. But if you become identified, one of the primary wounds that I see playing out in teenagers, I have seven kids between the ages of 15 and 22.
Amazing.
So I see this in my house every day. When you become attached to the idea that you were traumatized, and that becomes your identity, mm-hmm. there's a period of time in adolescence where, you know, you're trying on different suits. And, yeah, so you might try on trauma survivor. But if you decide to wear that for your whole life as your primary identity, I'm sad for you. I'm sad because of the initial trauma, but I'm also sad because there's no way out. And you're deciding it. So I think that there are a myriad ways to approach what growth looks like, what getting out of that looks like. But it all starts with believing in plasticity, mm-hmm. believing that you have some say in what happens next. And what I would ask, I guess, is whose agenda is served by believing that everything is fixed and static about mm-hmm. you?
Completely.
And if it's not yours, then
screw. Yeah, it's worth thinking about. Well, and also I've had conversations with folks where they're really insistent that, you know, they can't change their initial instinct to go to a certain, you know, emotional space. Right. You know, like they see their partner across the room, they get a flushed face, and they're like, there's no way for me to tamp that down. And I'm like, well, you know, the idea isn't necessarily to tamp it down. When you move all of your cups from one cupboard to another, you're going to go to that first cupboard first, you know, and your brain is going to forward that information to, oh, you know, the location of the cups is actually in a different cupboard now. And then you're immediately going to go to the second cupboard and get your cup. And if you keep doing that, eventually that forwarding time gets less and less and less and less until the thing you've built on top of the old thing is nearly instantaneous. You don't even think about the first cupboard anymore, but it probably still happens. Like, that's probably still a part of your, you know, network of thinking.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful metaphor. And I would say when it comes to jealousy, when the tidal wave comes. So if you're experiencing just low tidal wave, like just a tide coming in, you're not swept off your feet. And so that you can just let the overwritten code work for you. But when the tidal wave comes and you get knocked down, you might revert to your sort of core initial code. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. If you can find yourself in there, like separate from all the stuff, all the wounds that have happened and all that, and just say like, wow, you really got knocked around on that, and offer yourself a lot of compassion for how that feels, then you can still shorten the time it will take you to stand up, walk over to the second cupboard, maybe ask somebody else to open it for you. You know, there are so many ways that you could work with it. And it's not a one and done. You don't have to fix it and then it's solved. You get to keep working with all of those bumps and bruises and ways that you know, don't self-regulate really well. I'm still working with that. I'm sure you are. Mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. just life.
Yeah. I want to circle back to what you were saying about studies that you were conducting. I love that you're studying this not just in polyamorous folks, but also in monoamorous folks or monogamous folks, I suppose.
Yeah.
I just find it
yeah.
so like positive that these studies are being done side by side, because my experience of the literature is there's almost nothing not on middle class white individuals. And even yeah. the stuff that is on middle class white individuals is like, they feel like baby studies. Like they tend to be like low numbers of individuals, at least in the experiences that I've seen. I'm sure there are some higher ones out there, I'm sure. But yeah, anyways, my experience yeah. is just that they don't tend to be super fleshed out studies. And I really like the idea that you're doing your research on monogamous and polyamorous individuals as well. I'm curious yeah. If you could say more about that, like what your thought process was for your methodology.
Yeah, so I got really invested in the idea of looking at jealousy specifically, and then I needed to choose a container. Mm-hmm. I needed to figure out who I was going to perform this study on, as well as choose my method and make some decisions. And for me, it was an obvious choice. Being non-monogamous myself, it was an obvious choice to turn to the polyamorous community. And I used the word polyamorous to describe individuals when I was doing my search. I just chose mm-hmm. it for reasons.
Reasons.
And I found that container to be the obvious choice because it was my first official study. It was my doctoral study. And I wanted a group of people who I knew could talk about jealousy. And I knew that if I put a call out into the world of non-monogamous people and I said, hey, I'm looking for people between the ages of 25 and 55 who have experienced at least 2 years in non-monogamy and who have something to say about their experience of jealousy, I knew I would get answers, and I was not wrong. I had a huge response to the call. And so that was an obvious choice. But I knew even then that this study would need to be repeated. But it's interesting because I can't just repeat it verbatim, because the questions you ask a person who has the context of and the vocabulary of non-monogamy would not make sense to ask a polyamorous right. person. I mean, a monogamous person or a monoamorous person. It just wouldn't. So as I was redesigning my study, it was probably a good month and a half just working on the questions and seeing how I could keep the core idea behind the study the same while asking questions that would be intelligible to a monogamous audience, because Yeah, they're just different. They don't have the same frame of reference.
Right.
So, for instance, you know, talking about cheating, you just get a different, it's just a whole different thing. But when I chose my method, that was also really, really important to me. There are a lot of methods you can choose. I happen to prefer qualitative work versus quantitative work for this kind of study. Mm-hmm. I want the rich descriptions. And what that means is that my studies, the first one had 13 participants. The second one will have 14 when I'm finished. I'm still mid-collection of those interviews because I'm collecting them in subsamples of female, male, and non-binary participants. And that's female, male, inclusive of all people who identify as woman, man, and non-binary. So they self-describe.
Okay.
And what's happening is when you choose a method like this, you're committing to a small number of people giving you an in-depth look into their psychological experience of, their making sense of jealousy, right? So what I'm doing is the interpretative phenomenological analysis, and what it means is I am layering my making sense of their making sense of their experience of jealousy. And that all together starts to form a new picture of what jealousy is. And because I wanted to take an archetypal perspective, which means I wanted to take seriously the fact that the unconscious exists, that we don't know everything about ourselves, I wanted to invite people to go into a deep dive and describe what it feels like to be jealous. So I didn't want to just count instances of jealousy or count severity of jealousy. Mm. I wanted them to describe it to me. And that was really intentional and has proven to be really helpful, because what I find are there are different archetypal patterns of jealousy. For instance, there's one that's quite violent. There's another that is incredibly focused on the third, on the person who is perceived as the interrupter. Mm. Like for that one, it's really simple. That's hieratic jealousy. That's Hera, right? Like she's always focused on punishing the people who Zeus is sleeping around with, right? So like that's the way I selected to look at jealousy. And my goal is to continue to run studies on jealousy, looking at it from all these different angles. One of the things I haven't been able to control for yet, and it's really difficult, is my participants are far more white and middle class than mm-hmm. I would like. And that is, it is the problem of putting the calls out. Like you put the calls out and why would they trust me? So right. As I continue my research, I have to make contacts with people who will help me gain the confidence of people.
Yeah.
Who will, to share these stories, because it's tender
well,
material.
Well, if you're interested, you're always welcome to invite me to put a call out to my network, because I know that I do have a lot of BIPOC folks in my network, and some of them are non-monogamous for sure.
I really appreciate that, because I am, that is something I'm deeply committed to. And I know that it's probably going to be a life's work to just keep mm-hmm. doing this as positioned the way I am as a cisgender, white, you know, middle-class woman in America.
Sure.
I know I need to be very careful about not stating this as truths about jealousy in a whole sense.
Sure.
They're truths about jealousy from my perspective.
Yes. Two fun things to talk about. Actually, one specifically fun thing. Did you know that when we sent the Juno spacecraft to Jupiter, literally like Juno's moons are just all of the various mistresses and like affairs that Jupiter's
yeah.
had? And we sent the Juno spacecraft to Jupiter like,
yeah.
to observe.
I have to imagine that there are astronomers out there with a lot of deep humor about Greek mythology, given what we have named Greek and Roman mythology, given what we have named
sure.
everything out there. They must find this very humorous. And I agree.
I couldn't believe it. I was like, wait, we called the mission to Juno. I was like, we didn't name any of the moons after Jupiter's partner. And I was like, oh, we named all of them after Jupiter's partners.
Yeah, Io. And
so
yep,
when you talked
exactly.
about hieratic jealousy, that was the first thing I thought of, was the Juno spacecraft, because I'm a nerd like that.
I love that. And I think that it makes sense to me that we would do something like that. Because, yeah, so she's going to go spy on them. Sure. Yep. That's what she would do. Absolutely.
Yeah. Read all of Jupiter's texts.
Exactly. Oh, God, yes, definitely.
All right, I think that's all we have time for, unfortunately, but it was an absolute delight. Dr. Jolie Hamilton, thank you so much. I will have to listen to your podcast, the Project Relationship Podcast.
Great, thanks for having me. And yeah, there's an episode on there called Why Jealousy is the Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me, if you want to hear my personal story.
I would love to. Thank you so much. So how did you like it, Intimates? Discuss your ideas with the community at facebook.com/intimatevictor or tweet me at intimatevictor or follow my Instagram, you guessed it, at intimatevictor. If you can spare the cost of coffee to help the show keep going, head to patreon.com/victorsalmon. We hugely appreciate your help to continue making intimate conversations for you and yours. If not, you can always help other intimacy nerds find the podcast by leaving us a review anywhere online, especially iTunes. Or you can just tell a friend. The opening music is On Hold For You, made of algorithmically generated notes and chords and played by an AI-rendered saxophonist. The closing music is Gymnopédie No. 1 by Eric Satie. Both are provided royalty-free, courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Thanks so much for your time, and may your most important relationships be filled with the intimate, rich interactions you crave. Be well.